Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Belisarius and Antonina, Love and War in the Age of Justinian, by David Allan Parnell, narrated by Julia Antony. Publisher's note: in this audio edition, you will hear references to appendices present in the print and ebook formats of the book. Introduction. Although their names may not quite resonate with the public today, Belisarius and Antonina were titans in the Roman world some 1,500 years ago. Belisarius was the most well-known general of his age, victor over the Persians, conqueror of the Vandals and the Goths, and, as if this were not enough, wealthy beyond imagination. His wife Antonina was an impressive person in her own right. She made a name for herself by travelling with Belisarius on his military campaigns, deposing a pope, and scheming to disgrace important Roman officials. Together, the pair were extremely influential, and they arguably wielded more power in the Roman world than anyone except the emperor and empress themselves. This unadulterated power and wealth did not mean that Belisarius and Antonina were universally successful in all that they undertook. They occasionally stumbled militarily, politically, and personally in their marriage and with their children. These failures knock them from their lofty perch, humanize them, and make them even more relatable and intriguing as subjects of study. This book is an exploration of the marriage and partnership of Belisarius and Antonina. A dual portrait of this type has not previously been attempted, although there have been many biographies of Belisarius alone. What sets this book apart from, say, a military biography of Belisarius as general, is that here the focus is on the relationship between Belisarius and Antonina, and how that partnership enabled each of them to reach heights of power and success. For Belisarius and Antonina were not merely husband and wife, but also partners in power. This is a paradigm that might seem strange. We reflexively imagine that marriages in the ancient world were staunchly traditional, in that each partner had gendered roles, the husband in the public sphere and the wife in the domestic. But Antonina was not a reserved housewife, and Belisarius showed no desire for Antonina to remain in the home. Their private and public lives blended as they travelled together, sometimes bringing their children, and worked side by side. Belisarius and Antonina lived in the Roman Empire. By the time they achieved prominence in the 6th century, the Roman state was already incredibly ancient. Counting from the legendary founding of the city of Rome in 753 BC, the Roman polity was 1,282 years old by the time Belisarius became a general in 529 AD. Of course, the Roman world of 529 AD looked nothing like that of 753 BC. Over the course of centuries, Roman society had evolved from a small city-state, overlooking the Tiber River in central Italy, to a sprawling empire that stretched from the Atlantic Ocean to the Euphrates River, from northern Britain to southern Egypt. By 529, that empire had contracted, losing its western half, but remained quite substantial in size. Similarly, the Roman government had evolved over the centuries, from monarchy to republic, and then into an empire that was at first cloaked in republican language, and later more nakedly autocratic. In 395 AD, that government was divided for the last time between two different emperors. The line of emperors ruling in the west, from Italy, was extinguished in 476 AD. The line of emperors ruling in the east, at Constantinople, remained unbowed and unbroken, stretching back through the centuries to Augustus, acknowledged as the first of the Roman emperors. Though they lived in Constantinople rather than Rome, these were Roman emperors who ruled over Roman citizens and were the heads of state of a Roman government. This empire is sometimes called Byzantine, after the original Greek city at the site of Constantinople, named Byzantium, rather than Roman. However, modern historians disagree on a starting point for a Byzantine Empire, and some recently have argued that the term should not be used for any period of the medieval Roman state's history. In this book, the term Byzantine will not appear. The empire under discussion will be described only as the Roman Empire, and Belisarius and Antonina will be styled as Romans. One other significant aspect of the ancient Roman society's evolution over the course of these many centuries is the rise and triumph of Christianity. While this religion began in the 1st century AD as a small sect, persecuted by both Jewish religious authorities and, sporadically, by the Roman government itself, belief in Christ gained toleration and instant respectability with the conversion of the emperor Constantine I, ruled 306 to 337 AD. From this point, Christianity began to spread and displace ancient forms of polytheism across the Roman world. This process was still underway in the 6th century, and some pagan holdouts remained. But it does not seem that Belisarius and Antonina were among them. Their Christian faith is confirmed by, among other evidence, a papal letter referring to Antonina as a most Christian daughter of Pope Vigilius, ruled 537 to 555 AD, and a casual reference to Belisarius fasting prior to Easter 531. Belisarius and Antonina, therefore, were a part of the Christianization of Roman society, a process that did not come without growing pains and disagreements among believers. Belisarius and Antonina's sovereigns were the Emperor Justinian I, ruled 527 to 565 AD, and the Empress Theodora, ruled 527 to 548, who are themselves justly famous. Over the course of a 38-year reign, Justinian presided over building projects and revisions of the law code, mediated between Christian factions, and launched many wars. His wife, Theodora, was at his side for 21 of these years, and, like Antonina with Belisarius, she was known for her partnership with Justinian in government. Theodora inspired legislation, had a say in the selection of government ministers, and sheltered Christian dissidents. The empire that Justinian and Theodora ruled may have been smaller than in its heyday before the division between East and West, but it was still massive. The Romans governed southeastern Europe, south of the Danube, Anatolia, roughly corresponding to modern Turkey, and the Near East, bending from Syria south to Egypt. Even though this may seem like quite enough to rule, Justinian and Theodora also believed it to be their Roman and Christian duty to consider the safety and quality of life of Romans outside of their authority, to the west, in formerly Roman Italy and North Africa, and of Christians to the east, near and beyond the empire's borders with the powerful Persian Empire. Justinian and Theodora knew Belisarius and Antonina personally. It is hard to say exactly how close of friends these couples were, but the intricate operations that they pulled off in concert with one another point to a degree of trust. When they were all on the same page, these four ruled the Roman world and sought to fulfil great and difficult ambitions, including the conquest of other kingdoms and the reordering of the Roman government and of the Christian Church. When they occasionally quarrelled, it was inevitably Belisarius and Antonina who fell from favour. They were, after all, the pair without the crowns. This happened just frequently enough to give a whiff of drama to the relationship between Belisarius/Antonina and Justinian/Theodora, which was, over the long haul of their lives, mostly stable. Now that we have been introduced to Belisarius and Antonina, to Justinian and Theodora, and to the Roman world they called home, we need to become familiar with one more character, who must of necessity be an integral part of this book. Procopius of Caesarea was the most prominent historian of the century. Born in Caesarea, in modern Israel, he received a first-rate classical education, becoming a lawyer. When Belisarius received his first significant military command in 527, he hired Procopius to be his legal advisor, assessor, and personal secretary. This was an important position for the young Procopius, working for a powerful military officer, he could expect entry into the rarefied air of the upper levels of the Roman administration. The position became even more of a bonanza for Procopius when his employer, Belisarius, was promoted to general in 529, becoming one of the most important men in the Roman army. For the next 11 years, Procopius followed Belisarius and Antonina around the Mediterranean, from posting to posting. Probably in 540, Procopius left the service of Belisarius and settled in Constantinople to become a historian. He first began work on a massive history he called the Wars, which was to be a military history of the Wars of Justinian, with a significant focus on the role played by Belisarius, who is frequently portrayed as a heroic protagonist. Writing this massive work took years. The first 7 books of the Wars were probably completed and distributed in 551, and the 8th and last book followed in 554. While working on the Wars, Procopius also wrote a shorter, scandalous book, which is known as The Secret History. This is a libelous screed that savagely critiques Justinian, Theodora, Belisarius, and Antonina for the way they governed the Roman world. Procopius wrote it in the late 540s and stopped work on it, unfinished, around 550. The historian also wrote a book entitled On Buildings to praise Justinian's building projects, which he probably worked on, although possibly left incomplete in 554. Listeners of this book, who are satisfied with this brief introduction of Procopius and eager to get into the remarkable story of Belisarius and Antonina, may wish to proceed directly to chapter 1. Those who are curious that Procopius, who knew Belisarius and Antonina personally, would portray them so differently in the Wars and the Secret History, may wish to continue listening to learn why this was the case. Because we have no surviving documents that Belisarius or Antonina wrote themselves, and because Procopius knew them personally, the books that he wrote are our most detailed and knowledgeable contemporary account of the couple. Writing a history of Belisarius and Antonina without the works of Procopius would be virtually impossible. This means that any attempt to write about Belisarius and Antonina must grapple with the contrasting accounts of Procopius. In the Wars, Belisarius is often, but not always, portrayed as a heroic and successful general, and Antonina is shown as an intelligent, compassionate, and active spouse. In The Secret History, Procopius describes Belisarius as a submissive weakling, completely dominated by his powerful wife, paralleling the author's negative portrayals of Justinian and Theodora. Antonina controls Belisarius with spells, to the extent that he at first fails to notice, and then fails to punish her for having a sexual affair with their adopted son. No whisper of these outrageous accusations appears in the Wars or any other surviving source. Full examples of these two contrasting presentations of Belisarius and Antonina will of course be found in the remainder of this book. But as a preview, one might consider the different ways the two works portray the retreat of Belisarius from a campaign on the Persian front in 541. In the Wars, Belisarius has his army withdraw from Persian territory for valid military reasons, while in The Secret History, Belisarius withdraws in order to rush to confront Antonina over her alleged affair with their adopted son. To write a history of Belisarius and Antonina is therefore partially about reconciling Procopius with Procopius, the Wars with The Secret History. We can begin to do that by considering the nature of each of the two works and their intended audience. The Wars is a military history in the style of the histories of Thucydides, which recounted the Peloponnesian War, 431 to 404 BC. Procopius shows that he was familiar with the writing of Thucydides and numerous other ancient writers by incorporating many classical allusions to their texts into the Wars. Procopius intended this book to make him famous as a historian. This means that he wrote the Wars to be distributed and read by a wide audience. Because of the nature of literacy in the period, this audience was probably limited to the elites of the Roman world, and the book would have perhaps appealed most to those who worked in the military or civilian government. Most importantly, this audience would have included Justinian, Belisarius, and their wives. Procopius implies in On Buildings that he had received favour from the emperor, and this favour was likely bestowed by Justinian for the completion of the wars, since Belisarius and Antonina would have had access to the wars. It seems likely that most, if not all, of the characterizations of these individuals and their actions in that book would have been acceptable to them. This does not mean that every description of Belisarius and Antonina in the wars is historical truth, or, on the other hand, political propaganda, only that the words in it often aligned with the couple's own view of how the events unfolded. In addition, the author's depiction of relations between the genders, such as the relationship between Antonina and Belisarius, was probably considered normal by most of the readers of this work. In other words, the depiction of the active role of Antonina in her relationship with Belisarius is presented as something typical, and the elites of the period would not have been surprised by what they read in this work. The secret history is, however, a very different beast. It is not strictly a work of history, but rather an invective. In The Secret History, Procopius seeks to make Justinian, Theodora, Belisarius, and Antonina look bad by coming up with the most outrageous and salacious accusations against them. It resembles a hyperbolic legal argument that might have been made against these powerful people by those who felt wronged by them. Because the purpose is invective rather than history, we should not expect all of the charges in The Secret History to be historical truth, any more than we might expect modern, vitriolic political campaign advertisements to reflect the exact truth. Since The Secret History is so harsh on some of the most powerful people in the Roman world, it stands to reason that its audience was intended to be quite smaller than that for the wars. Far from expecting The Secret History to be read widely, Procopius intended it for only extremely limited distribution, and only in particular circumstances. It is possible that Procopius wrote The Secret History in anticipation of a revolution that would overthrow Justinian and those closest to him, such as Belisarius and Antonina. In the event of that revolution, the scurrilous pamphlet would prove to the new ruler that Procopius was not actually any longer aligned with his former employer, Belisarius, and the emperor Justinian, and therefore was not a threat to the new regime. In this way, The Secret History served as insurance against the possibility that Procopius might be swept out with the old order by the new emperor. Under these circumstances, Procopius would have every reason to make the invective in the book as outrageous as possible, while also still making it convincing enough that the new regime would buy it as something more than simple fiction. However, the revolution that Procopius imagined never came to pass, and there is no evidence that the author outlived Justinian. Given this, it seems likely that very few, or perhaps even none of Procopius's contemporaries read The Secret History. It was perhaps left in storage and discovered after the author's death. The earliest certain reference to the text in another surviving work is in the Suda, an encyclopedia compiled in the 10th century. It should be said that not all modern historians would accept these characterizations of the nature of the wars and The Secret History. Scholarship on the works of Procopius continues to evolve, and consensus is difficult to achieve. However, these characterizations of the works of Procopius allow us to create a framework for the purpose of examining the lives of Belisarius and Antonina. In general, in this book, I will treat accounts of Belisarius and Antonina in the wars as descriptions of which they would approve, or at least not violently oppose. This does not mean, however, that we should take every description of the couple in the wars at face value. In particular, because it was written for an audience that included Belisarius and Antonina, some of the anecdotes about them in this work downplay or ignore their failures. Individual episodes in the wars still need to be scrutinized for their accuracy. In general, I will approach the secret history as invective rather than history, but will treat that invective as though it is based on a kernel of historical truth. Invective is more effective when it is based in truth, which a talented writer like Procopius would have realised while composing this work. In order to make the invective believable to the hypothetical new regime, Procopius would have wanted to make sure that the accusations could at least in part be verified by common knowledge or other sources. Therefore, many of the slanderous tales told about Belisarius and Antonina in the secret history may in fact have a basis in historical reality that was then exaggerated by Procopius to make the couple look as bad as possible. For example, consider the way that Procopius's sexual slander of Theodora in the secret history is probably grossly exaggerated, yet rooted in common knowledge of the Empress's background as an actress. This framework underpins the analysis of the works of Procopius in this book and helps to bring to light Belisarius and Antonina, who were not always as successful as the wars makes them seem, but were not as terribly villainous as the secret history would have it either. 1. The World of Antonina. The story of one of the greatest and most unusual marital partnerships of the ancient Roman world begins with the birth, sometime near the end of the 5th century of this era, of a baby named Antonina. Almost nothing is known of the circumstances of her birth, but the historian Procopius, while refusing to name her parents, does at least record their occupations. Her mother was an actress, and her father a charioteer. This revelation opens a window onto the world into which Antonina was born. Roman cities of this period, including the capital Constantinople, were completely swept up by enthusiasm for public entertainment. There were two chief forms of spectacle, which Antonina's parents just so happened to represent through their professions: performances in theatres and chariot races in large arenas known as hippodromes. The theatre of the 6th century was bawdy, raucous and fun, rather than stately, serious and intellectual. It was completely dominated by dancing pantomimes, backed up by singing choruses. The pantomimes were the stars and lead performers, while the choruses were made up of nearly anonymous backup singers. Their performances were often informed by ancient myth and contained a healthy dose of lewdness and sexual situations. For instance, Procopius claims that the Empress Theodora, in her days as an actress in the theatre, was famous for an act in which she lay on her back, scantily attired, and allowed geese to peck grains of barley off of her body. This act has been identified as a satirical reference to the tale in Greek mythology, in which Zeus, in the form of a swan, rapes the princess Leda. Although Procopius tells this story and others about the actress Theodora in an attempt to discredit her, it is clear that such acts were immensely popular, and that Procopius himself had personal knowledge of their contents. Roman society, despite the growing importance of the Christian church, was not prudish. Plays with a focus on adultery were not uncommon. Euripides's Hippolytus, in which a married woman lusts after her stepson, was particularly popular in both art and theatre at the time. Some indication of the massive popularity of theatrical shows comes from the fact that a ban on pantomimes could be considered a significant punishment. In 522, the Emperor Justin I banished such performers across the empire after a major riot in Constantinople. Theatrical shows aroused such excitement and passions that they themselves could spark riots, which could again invite bans, as happened in Antioch in 529. When not jamming into theatres to leer at pantomime acts, urban Romans crowded into the local hippodrome to watch intense chariot races. These races were typically held on special event days, during which there would be between 8 and 24 separate races. In a race, 4 chariots pulled by teams of 4 horses each would compete. The rules of the standard race would have been familiar to modern observers. The chariots began in starting boxes, whose gates were opened at the same moment. The first chariot to cross the finish line after a lap around the track was crowned the winner. There were some variations. A popular one was the Diversium, in which after the first race, the charioteers exchanged horses and chariots, and then raced again. This provided an opportunity for the winning charioteer of the first race to prove that he won because of his skill, not because of his horses and equipment. Charioteers were immensely popular individuals. The best were cheered by their fans and jeered by the fans of their opponents by name. They might also be honoured by statues inscribed with a record of their victories and erected inside the racetrack for all to see. Porphyrius was perhaps the most popular and successful charioteer of the 6th century and was honoured by at least 7 statues. Charioteers enjoyed considerable mobility, sometimes moving to a different city or team, much like modern superstar athletes. The hippodromes in which these races took place were elliptical-shaped arenas, and some could be quite large. The largest one was the Circus Maximus in Rome, but hippodromes could also be found in most large cities across the Mediterranean, including Alexandria, Antioch, and Thessaloniki. At the time of Antonina's birth, the most important hippodrome was that of Constantinople. It stood in the southeastern portion of the city, today's Sultanahmet Square, directly adjacent to the Great Palace, the home of the emperors. The massive structure was some 118 metres wide and 450 metres long. Its capacity was enormous, about 100,000 people. The two seemingly disparate public entertainments of theatre and hippodrome were tied together by the professional athletic teams that historians called the factions. These organisations were originally 4 in number, the Blues, Greens, Whites and Reds. However, by the 6th century, the Whites and Reds had been absorbed by the Blues and Greens respectively. In a chariot race, one chariot bore each of the 4 team colours, but there were only the 2 administrative structures of the Blues and Greens. Originally private organisations, the Blues and Greens were bureaucratised in the 5th century. The government paid and organised the teams to provide free public spectacles for the people in the name of the emperor. The Blue and Green factions not only administered and put on the chariot races, but were also responsible for hiring pantomimes, dancers and singers, and organising theatrical shows. Thus, employees of the factions ran the gamut from actresses to charioteers, and all the assorted support staff required. The Blues and Greens inspired intense fandom, comparable to modern football clubs and their supporters. The most extreme and dedicated fans were known as partisans. They were a radical minority, who were the loudest and rowdiest spectators, both in the hippodrome and in the theatre. Most fans were not so extreme, but it does seem that almost all inhabitants of major cities did identify as fans of one faction or another. This mania for the Blues and Greens, and public spectacle as a whole, coexisted uneasily with the powerful Christian Church. Clergy generally disapproved of both chariot racing and theatrical performances, seeing these as rivals that lured the people away from church, and connected them to ancient pagan traditions. Ecclesiastics criticised these spectacles quite openly. The ecclesiastical historian, John of Ephesus, described a hippodrome as a church of Satan. The contemporary bishop, Severus of Antioch, railed against those who look on the vile gyrations of the dancing madness with their many turns, and in the thought of their heart wander as in deep darkness. Condemnations like these did little to dampen the popularity of such entertainments. This urban Roman landscape of massively popular public entertainments was the world of Antonina's parents. If Procopius is to be believed, of the 2 of them, Antonina's mother had the less exalted position. The author introduces her as one of those types who wore themselves on the stage. This unflattering description reveals the disdain that Procopius had for those who acted, an attitude that was shared by other elite Romans, Actors and actresses, although they might attract large...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?